This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, we're deep into the 2013-2014 college football season. Fans are flocking to the hallowed ground of their team's home stadium, be it the Big House for you Wolverines, Spartan Stadium for MSU fans, Kelly Shorts Stadium for you Chips. Well, no one can argue the fact that no matter which metric you use, whether it's attendance, TV ratings, revenue for the NCAA, money into the coffers of the college or university, college football is huge. But Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubacon is deeply worried about the future of college football, and he fears it may be losing its soul and with it the support of fans and players. His new book is a deep dive into the Big Ten during the 2012 season called Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. And John, it's always good to see you here in the studio.
Likewise, Cindy.
So full disclaimer here. I am the last person in the world that anybody would say is a football fan. I'm the one who goes to Spartan Stadium to spend time with my daughter, who's a student there. And I jump for joy because the marching band comes out performing selections from Les Miserables for the halftime show. But I really, really liked your book because the stories you tell as you take us deep into those locker rooms and those coaches' offices of four Big Ten universities during that 2012 season are fantastic stories and gripping and emotional. You take us to Michigan, Penn State, Ohio State, and Northwestern. Of course, we know you're a Michigan man. Why did you pick those four?
Because the Big Ten, I feel, is the last best chance for college football to make it stand. If it's going to be academically based, reasonably clean, and competitive. The Ivy Leagues don't care about wins or attendance. The SEC seems to care less about the other stuff. They're winning all the national titles, but they don't seem to have quite the same values, I believe, as the Big Ten. So if the Big Ten can't compete, then the enterprise is almost kaput. The Big Ten, these teams, they're not the canaries in the coal mine. They're the coal miners. Yeah, okay. If Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, Northwestern cannot compete doing it the way they're doing it, then really nobody can.
Okay.
And you're basically one big step towards a real minor league.
You got in there and got incredible, intimate detail as coaches and players planned the next game and licked their wounds after losses and celebrated their wins. And especially at Penn State, after the whole Jerry Sandusky debacle, how did you get such incredible access to these coaches and players and these ADs?
In some cases, dumb luck. In the case of Bill O'Brien at Penn State, it just so happened he'd read my fourth book, which is Bo's Lasting Lessons, which I wrote with Bo Schembechler here in Ann Arbor. I met him the day before his spring game. He was there at a banquet for the groundbreaking for the new ice rink. And he's sitting there, there's an empty seat, and the guy beyond the empty seat is Josh Brandwine, the new women's coach at Penn State. He and I happened to coach at the Penn State hockey camp 20 years ago. I walk up to him and thank the Lord. He remembers me and says, Bakes. Yeah. I said, yes.
I'm in.
I'm going to sit here for a little while. Bill and I hit it off. And really, the whole book starts with Bill O'Brien. If he did not give me access, this is just not the book it's going to be. And the fascinating part about Penn State, we all know about Sandusky, ad nauseum. We all know about Paterno, of course. This book really picks up after all that comes down, after the sanctions are levied, which is doggone near a death penalty. If you're a 19 or 20-year-old kid in this team, and you did not even know who Sandusky was till he was arrested, and you came here to Penn State, you turned down money at other places, illegal money, you came here to Penn State with a 91% graduation rate, you've got all the right values, now what do you do?
Yeah.
You're offered a chance to transfer, there's no bowl games, they're going to cut your scholarships. They're going to let other teams recruit your players. And they had 100 coaches in the parking lot the next day. That's what vultures these coaches can be. And incredibly, almost all of these guys stayed. And in this little lab experiment, basically, by taking away all the variables, we see, I think, the true heart and soul of college football. The disaster speaks for itself, but it's not on these 19-year-olds.
Yeah.
And it's the players that I have great faith in. They are actually true believers. The fans are true believers. The band members are true believers. It's the adults who are scaring the hell out of me. And I think we'll kill this golden goose.
And this is across all of the four schools that you're looking at, in a sense, because you find things at each school that worry you and also that excite you. As you did that, as you looked at the students and you looked at the coach and the AD and you looked at the whole package, what most alarmed you about what you're seeing in the Big Ten college football
today? That's a great question. The thing that I was most reassured by were the players. The thing I was less reassured by was just about everything else. The rush for money now is this car used to have a gas pedal and brakes, and there's always been a struggle for a century. It was always a tug of war. It's no longer a tug of war. The car has got a gas pedal and the brake line has been cut. And this thing is flying down the hill with no one saying slow down or stop.
And making loads of money.
If you were a freshman at Michigan in 69 on the football team, your head coach, Bo Schembechler, is making $21,000. Those are not even digits in a contract anymore. It's X point X. And it's a million after it, of course. So it's $3-5 million. Les Miles at LSU had a deal in his contract. If he won the national title game 2 years ago, one game, he would get a $5 million bonus for 60 minutes of football. His players, all they got is 15 practices to prepare for that game. No extra anything out of that deal. At that point, the thing is going to break.
I'm speaking with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. His latest book is Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. Let's circle back, John, to what I just felt. It got my emotional goosebumps raised, and that was the story of these Penn State players and Coach Bill O'Brien, literally engulfed in the fallout from this Jerry Sandusky guilty verdict. First of all, more on your thoughts on the sanctions from the NCAA and how they didn't even belong, in your view.
In my view, I certainly get the view that, look, what happened there was so unspeakably horrible. And this is not sexual assault. This is not, you know, harassment, whatever.
Yeah.
Let's be clear about this. He is raping 10-year-old boys. And as Mike Motti says, the star linebacker at Penn State, he said, you know, in the old days at the Center County Courthouse, they used to hang guys in the front yard. He said, I'm cool with that. In fact, give me the rope. Mm. I mean, these players have no sympathy for Sandusky whatsoever, and nor should they. But to me, the NCAA, it's not an enforcement agency. They've got no sentencing guidelines. They've got no principles they follow. No moral compass. All it is now is a marketing organization. If the public's upset, we'll whack them. If the public is not upset, we don't care.
We look the other way.
UNC just had a scandal where dozens of players, football and basketball, were taking, not even taking the courses, getting credits for courses they didn't show up for, didn't take any test papers and so on. And the NCAA conveniently says that, well, other students took those courses as well, so it's not an NCAA issue. If not handling academic fraud, as Mike Motti says, if they're not doing that, what are they doing? Mm. So my take on the Penn State sanctions is, yeah, I get it. I mean, put Sandusky in jail forever, and all his enables, put them in jail also. But to put the NCAA in charge of something this serious, to me, is equivalent to putting a meter maid in charge of a serial murder. You're in over your head. These guys adjudicate on whether or not you're allowed to give the players bagels for a snack for breakfast. You're allowed to put butter on it. But if you put cream cheese or jam, it becomes a meal and is an infraction. This is what they do. They should not be in charge of child rapists. Sorry. Mm. You handled jelly on bagels. You're in over your head.
And by lowering the hammer the way they didn't, as you point out, didn't give Penn State the death penalty, but they set it up so the vultures could come swooping in and do the job for them.
Exactly right. It's a very slow death penalty. I'm sure they fully expected the players to leave like rats of a ship. They set it up that way. Normally, you've got to take a year off after a transfer to practice with the team but not playing games. They killed that rule, say you guys can play immediately, and the opposing coaches, as I said earlier, can show up immediately and recruit you.
One would argue, though, if you're sitting there thinking, well, the kids may want out. You know, they won't have the opportunity for greater glory and all the sanctions that went with them. One might argue that maybe looked like a good idea.
First blush, I get the idea, and I don't doubt for a second there were some good intentions behind this. Yeah. I also don't doubt for a second the NCAA's got no idea how this thing actually works, and they can't think two steps ahead for their lives. Any senior in that team can tell you exactly what's going to happen, which is what did happen, and what the NCAA probably expected to happen didn't happen. These guys really didn't leave.
You focused on the two mics.
Awesome.
Tell us a little about who they are and what these two boys, the Bang Brothers, right?
That's right.
And Coach OB, and what they did to coalesce that team.
Mike Motti, whose dad played for Penn State and also played for the New Orleans Saints, and Michael Zordich, whose dad was a captain in the mid-'80s and on a national title team for Joe Paterno in the 80s. These guys were born and bred, you know, with the Penn State everything, and they were raised that way. They were recruited by Joe Paterno. They turned down money to go to other schools, you know, illegal money and so on. This is what they wanted. And when this happens, I mean, they're just, it's a brick in the face, as Mike Motti says. So the next morning, they wake up, 6 o'clock in the morning, and their phones are blowing up. 40, 50 calls from coaches around the country who somehow all got their numbers that fast. Again, the vulture aspect cannot be underestimated. They go immediately to Craig Fitzgerald's office, the strength coach's office. They lay out all the underclassmen who said, I'm leaving, he's leaving, he's leaving. Mm. Basically, the entire freshman and sophomore classes are prepared to leave that day. And they're telling the seniors, Penn State football is dead. And they believed it. They had reason to believe it. So they walk in, they make a chart of who's leaving, who's not. Bill O'Brien comes running down to the strength coach's office. And they make a plan right then and there to start saving the team. And they fan out. They're making phone calls, dorm room visits, talking to girlfriends, parents, roommates. And they save the team.
I'd like, if you would, to read us an excerpt from your book. And this is at the point when all of that hard work has been done. And virtually no one left.
Yeah, a few stars.
Silas Red.
Yeah, but almost nobody.
When he gets picked up by Snoop Dogg in a limo for USC. But it is finally time for Coach O'Brien and these kids to play that first game of the season.
The fans under the stands were loud during warmups and louder still right before kickoff, as loud and crazy as any I've ever seen. From the dark reaches under the stadium, the players walked towards sunlight. At the end of the tunnel, the ushers slowly swung open the huge wrought iron gates to the field. Players rushed past the cameraman, the band, and the cheerleaders through a path lined by young varsity athletes and aging football lettermen. O'Brien was right. The entire run was close to 100 yards, but he did not pull a hamstring or trip, and Gerald Hodges didn't fall over him. The cheering was not just loud, but sustained. The fans had been waiting for this moment for 10 months. They longed for it every time their school absorbed another blow, which seemed to arrive daily. They needed this. This was football. This was their team. There'd be no investigations or news reports today or any need to criticize or defend their alma mater. Just a bunch of college kids running out onto the grass in their famed midnight blue jerseys with the stark white numbers and, for the first time, their names on the back.
It is quite a story to get a sense, and the access you got to these kids was tremendous.
Behind the wall. I mean, locker room during halftime.
Yeah.
If the coach threw a chair, I ducked. I was close enough for that.
We're sitting here at Michigan Radio, so we absolutely have to talk a little about the Wolverines. And tell me what the takeaway was as far as the program, what's being done right, what you are concerned about.
Sure. I did not have access to the team. No one does these days under Dave Brandon. That's his prerogative. But I did have great access, of course, to the fans. You can't stop that. And I talked at length to fans both in a broad spectrum as well as a few friends at close quarters repeatedly through the season, which kind of forms a Greek chorus, if you will.
Yes, it is like the Greek chorus.
As they become disaffected with all the changes, the new uniforms, the higher ticket prices, and so on. These are guys I grew up with here in Ann Arbor. One of them is Paul Barnett, a Washtenaw County prosecutor. His parents both went to Michigan. They played in the alumni band. Mm-hmm. And when he's a 10-year-old kid in Ann Arbor, he and his buddies would go door-to-door, knocking on doors, playing their cornets and trombones, hail to the victors, and let's go blue, and so on. These are true believers. And as we meet with them three or four times during the season, by the end, Paul Barnett says, with two kids, I am just about done with Michigan football. Because the suits will find your fun, they'll buy it up, and they'll settle back to you at a buck a yard, and it's a lot more than a buck a yard now. And that's why they're getting disaffected, I think. Another friend of mine said, a great quote, Michigan football used to be something that we shared. Now it seems like something they buy up, they lock it up, and they only bring it out if you're willing to pay for it. And the sense of generosity, the sense that we're all in this together, it's still there, but it's being tested by the severe money factor.
When you say the suits, are you talking Dave Brandon? Are you talking NCAA? Are you talking ESPN? Who are?
Yes.
Yes. All of the above.
Yes, exactly. Look, I mean, on the positive side, Dave Brandon does bring a CEO approach. The money has never been higher. He's increased the budget by about 40%. In just 3 years. That's an incredible leap from $100 million to, it's going to be $144 or so million in his fourth year coming up. It's an incredible jump. The revenue is incredible. The teams are very successful, no question about it. So as far as that goes, it's all working very well. What you also see, though, is fans in larger and larger numbers dropping their season tickets. In my section that I sat in for the first time in years the other day, all the people I knew in my section were either in the end zone, they'd moved, and we're only on the 10-yard line. They're not that special.
Mm-hmm.
They moved to the end zone or they gave it up altogether. And that is happening with increasing frequency. You see them selling tickets on the big scoreboards in packages of 10. If you're doing that, I cannot believe you're sold out for every game anymore. How can you sell tickets if you were?
So you're seeing disaffected fans. And in your book, you talk, John, about players and that there was even talk that there was perhaps one team, you don't say who, that was going to come out for the basketball finals and maybe sit down on the bench and not play. Because of this question, it was on the cover of Time magazine. Should college athletes be paid? And so should they?
I'm a dinosaur on this one. I'm against the playoff. I'm against the 12th game. I'm against league title games. I'm against league expansion. So I'm probably in a small minority at this point. But I still believe in the student athlete. I've seen enough of them to know that it can work. I still believe in amateur athletics. What I believe you need to do is set up a separate minor league system. For those who don't want to be students, who shouldn't be students, who want to get paid, there's a place for you to go. This works beautifully in baseball and hockey. And we still have great college baseball. We still have great college hockey. They sell out the big rinks every game, including Michigan, of course. And the people you have on campus in those situations actually want to be college students. Right now, we've got one tunnel that's supposed to fit all for the NBA and the NFL. There's no way that can work. And it hasn't ever really worked. And it's going to work worse and worse in the years to come. Ron Warhurst, the Michigan track coach, who produced countless All-Americans, quite a few Big Ten titles, he had a great line. It's in the book. We're there at the Pioneer parking lot across from Michigan Stadium. And he says, man, one of these days, those guys are going to run out of that tunnel, sit down on the benches across the field, and not get up. And then what do you do? When your coach is making $21,000, you don't have much of a complaint. When your athletic director is making $1 million and flies in corporate jets and gets, you know, rented limousines in New York for his travel when you can't even afford a junker, at some point the contrasts become a bit glaring.
Although people will say, look, they're getting scholarship. A lot of the teams get the best quarters on campus. They get cared for. So, I mean, they're not hurting.
I agree with that. And I broke it down in the last book that it's around for a fifth-year senior at Michigan, and most of these guys do go for 5 years, at least in football. Fifth-year seniors, if you're a lineman from Illinois or Ohio, if you're out-of-stater, they actually pay the tuition by a check up the hill, and they pay retail. Anyone listening now from Toledo, Ohio knows exactly. If you added it all up, it comes to $586,000 as of 2 years ago. And that does not include, by the way, a lot of things that you get, academic center, the training help, the strength coaches, and so on. You can probably get up to $750,000 pretty quickly. So for all but a few players, it actually is a decent deal, but only if you care about the education. Okay. There are plenty of players who don't want that or don't care about it, and I give you Kentucky basketball. They go for one and done, 1 year and done, which really means you're going to school for one semester because you don't go at all January on, because by the time you flunk out, it's after the national title game, and you don't care.
And you're off to the NBA.
You are.
Bottom line, John, as you digest all of this and present it to us, which side do you think is going to win in college football, passion or profit?
Right now, profit is winning in a landslide. It's not even a battle. But if they do, quote-unquote, win, they will win the battle but not the war. Because if profits win out over passion, we will lose the passion for this. If we lose the passion for this, the profits will go away. And as cautionary tales go, look at boxing and look at horse racing. These used to be, with baseball, the three big sports. You can turn us off by squeezing too much, getting greedy, and at that point, this beautiful bonfire will walk away when the fire goes out.
The book is Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football, and presented by Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. Must be good to have this done and out there for the world. I know you've been
that
working
it
on it very, very, very hard.
You've seen my haggard face in the studio many weeks.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you, Cindy.